Hey, Truth Seekers, Mike Malloy here. As promised, a series of interviews I conducted this morning in Washington, D.C. regarding the Affordable Care Act. Sit back and enjoy. Tonight and tomorrow night, we're going to be talking to a bunch of folks about the Affordable Care Act and the craziness that's going on here in D.C. This hour is being sponsored by Benjamin Kirshner. He says, at times I thought you were a bit too far off political correctness and we're hitting a bit low and hard against the other side of the aisle, but every time I try to listen for a few minutes to right-wing American talk radio, I remember what the American liberal middle is up against. Hit lower, hit harder, keep it lit. Ben from the Social Democratic governed Canadian province of Manitoba. Jesus, thanks, Ben. Our first guest is Vincent DeMarco. He has been the president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative. He's known for his involvement and achievements with the Maryland Fair Share legislation, so-called, which required large businesses to provide quality health care for employees. Vince, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Just a minute ago, you and I were talking about my position, which is that I hold out for single payer, and I'm irritated the public option wasn't offered, and you pretty much told me that's the wrong attitude. Do that again.
Well, the sad fact is that, well, first of all, the Affordable Care Act is a great law that will expand health care to 30 million Americans and is already helping young people up to age 26 to enter parents' health care, giving grants to small businesses, and in many ways helping all of us get it for more affordable health care. When people are asked to express their views on it, many people who would like all these specific parts of the plan say they don't like the whole measure because they think it's single-payer health care or a step to single-payer, and it is not. Mm-hmm. It is an American-based way to achieve health care for all in a way that builds on public and private partnerships that makes sense if Americans look at it. The American people do not want, the majority of them do not want, one government plan for everybody. What they want is what the Affordable Care Act creates. Mm-hmm. And there's misconception out there that it's a step towards single-payer health care. It is not. And I think it's important that Americans of goodwill of all political stripes look at this law for what it really is. And if you are a single-payer advocate, I urge you to support it and don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. And look at what this does to help millions of people get health care. If you don't like single-payer, look at it and you'll see that it is a law that makes sense, that builds on the public-private partnerships that have been around and makes health care work. It's built on the model of what has worked in Massachusetts. Mm. Massachusetts has expanded health care to 97% of its citizens, hundreds of thousands who didn't have it before, and has a connector, which in other states is being called an exchange, which brings people together to increase the bargaining power with insurance companies and to promote effective ways to make health care more affordable, so that in Massachusetts, insurance premiums are going up at a much smaller rate than around the rest of the country. This is a plan that works, and I encourage other states to make it happen. Now, one of the ways that we're making it work in Maryland is by increasing our taxes on tobacco and alcohol, which reduces teen smoking and underage drinking, saves a lot of lives, and brings in money that helps make health care work. I'll give you an example of a woman in Maryland who was helped by this Medicaid expansion. She's a woman who has kids, whose husband works full-time. They couldn't afford health care like many others. Mm-hmm. She went to try to get health care for her kids and was told, well, under new law by our government, Governor Martin O'Malley, you now have the ability to have health care yourself. She was so thrilled. A couple weeks later, she started feeling ill. If she hadn't had that new card, she would have tried to sleep it off. Instead, mm-hmm. she went to a doctor, and the doctor said, thank goodness you came here. You were developing something that would have killed you. And because she had this new Medicaid card, which 30 million people are going to get in a couple of years, she was able to get preventive care and stay alive. That helped her, of course, saved her, saved her family. But most importantly, people to understand, it helped all of us. If she had not had that Medicaid card, she would have gotten very sick, probably not died right away, gone into hospital, mm-hmm. run up huge bills. Who would have paid for it? All of us. Every time we pay an insurance premium, $1,000 of it go to health care for the uninsured, uncompensated hospital care. This is what is working in Maryland, and it's going to work around the country.
But how does that differ, what you just described to me, how does that differ from single payer?
Well, she was able to get health care through Medicaid because she's so low income that she couldn't afford health care.
Right.
She couldn't afford it at all. If you could afford it, you will have options to be able to purchase it through private health care companies. The fact is, most Americans like the health care they're on,
mm-hmm.
the health insurance program they're on. They don't want to be taken off that and put on one government-run
but what about
program.
But what about the people that can't afford these premiums?
Well, under the Affordable Care Act, if you're below what 133% of poverty, which for a family of four is around $30,000 a year, mm-hmm. you will get full coverage under the Medicaid program. No premiums. You will get health care, and we'll all be better off because you won't have high uncompensated hospital care. If you're above that, you will get, not far above that, you will get subsidies to be able to afford the health care through these exchanges. And if you make really high amount of money, you'll have an individual responsibility to purchase health care. One of the problems we have today is people who have a good amount of money who don't purchase health care, and if they get real sick, we still pay their hospital bills.
Mm-hmm.
So they're required to do their fair share, which makes sense. But this plan is a plan that makes sense for the United States. Single payer may make sense for other places. In America, this is what makes sense.
All right, what about now this hearing before the Supreme Court that's going on today and tomorrow and probably Wednesday, and then a decision in a couple of months. How secure do you feel regarding that section that's under challenge, which is the individual mandate? Because without the individual mandate, how, you know, the Massachusetts plan, this plan, that plan, all falls apart.
It is the individual responsibility provision is a critical part of this law, and I think the Supreme Court's going to uphold it because it's clearly constitutional under the Commerce Clause, which allows the federal government
right.
to make sure that our public welfare is okay and that interstate commerce isn't badly impacted. If you have a significant amount of money and make an active decision not to purchase health care,
mm-hmm.
you're impacting all of us, because
right.
if you run up these huge hospital bills, we all pay, and huge hospital bills clearly impact interstate commerce. So I think the Supreme Court's going to uphold it. What I think the Supreme Court will understand is if they don't let Congress do this, maybe they couldn't do the Social Security law, the civil rights laws, the Medicare and Medicaid laws. They were all underpinned by the Commerce Clause. And I believe that the Supreme Court's going to understand they don't want to go 75 years in reverse.
Mm. Well, the only thing that concerns me about that part of it, Vince, is the fact that this Supreme Court made law with the corporations or people.
Citizens United
case. They actually, this is what the right always charges the left. That law is made on the judicial level. The Supreme Court actually did it. What gives you confidence that they're not going to take a look at this and, from an ideological point of view, say, okay, let's get rid of this?
Well, one of the things that gives me confidence is that some of the judges out there who affirm this law are very conservative judges.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was a protege of Justice Scalia. And these are just judges who looked at this from a conservative standpoint and realized that it's based on precedent.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on 75 years of court law, which has upheld the fact that in these modern times, Congress and the President can regulate interstate commerce in a way that makes us all better off. And I don't think they're going to want to undermine that.
Well, regarding what this Supreme Court does, I hope you're right. I'm very pessimistic about the Supreme Court. We'll see what happens.
Right.
But the overarching issue of supporting ACA on its merits,
right.
rather than going for single payer rather than seeing the ACA as an attempt. And your advice is to stop that.
It is not.
Ouch. And here's that break train. I'm sorry, Vince. We got to end it right there. Two Seekers, stick around. We have much more coming up. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Guest now is Ethan Rome. He is the Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, HCAN. He's been a grassroots labor activist organizer for progressive issues for more than 25 years. And during the drive to win the Affordable Care Act, Ethan was the Deputy Campaign Manager and led the coalition's polling, message, and paid media work, coordinated major national events. You also worked on Congress, right? It was your job to work with members of Congress?
I helped with our legislative team, but our legislative team ran that work.
I was just talking to Vince DiMarco about, I guess the bottom line is the perfect standing in the way of the good, and his position is single payer or the public option is not something that is doable and that we should accept the Affordable Care Act as is. Do you agree with that?
Here's what I think. I think you do things in steps. What we fought for was the left of what's possible. We fought for the best of what's possible. We were the leading organization fighting for the public option. That's where our efforts were focused. But we also wanted to make sure that we ended insurance company abuses, that we made it possible for more people to get coverage, that we helped senior citizens afford their health care. And those are things that this law accomplishes. It's a remarkable law, and it's a down payment. It's a first step. We're not done. But in the meantime, we have to protect the law, and it's under assault. It's under assault by the right-wing Republicans who want to get rid of this law. They want to decimate Medicaid, and they want to eliminate Medicare as we know it. They're funded by the billionaire Koch brothers, and if you want to judge your effort, you can judge it by the people you're against.
How effective is this campaign going to be, do you think, where it concerns this extremely conservative Supreme Court, which, by the way, seems to be more than willing to dismantle the social safety net? How effective is the argument against the mandate going to be where it concerns these justices? I think we all know that there is a serious right-wing drift, if not position, of the court. So when this is argued, this one provision, what's your best take on how the justices are going to rule?
I really believe that this law is constitutional on the merits. And in this instance, I think that the court is deeply concerned about how it is perceived by the American public. It's concerned about its integrity, whether or not it's going to do the right or the wrong thing. And so I think that they're going to rule that the law, they're going to uphold the law. Because what the last thing that they need to do in an election year is throw the Constitution out, bring the politics in, and make a decision that has no basis in law, no basis in 70 years of jurisprudence. I don't think they're going to do that.
But I would want to agree with you, but the fact that it is an election year, the fact that the push is in this country to the right, you know, the swing justice, Kennedy, who usually is the swing, I believe, to convince him that this is constitutional, that the Congress does have the power to do this. It just concerns me to the point where if this is thrown out, I'll tell you what I'm afraid of, Ethan, that they're going to do like they did with Citizens United. Rather than just ruling on the mandate, they're going to rule on other aspects of this and throw the whole thing out.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I think if we look at the merits, everyone is trying to read the tea leaves, so who knows, right? And so it's crazy to speculate, but Scalia and Kennedy both have written opinions in the last 10 years where they have written opinions about the Commerce mm-hmm. Clause that suggest that they might rule in favor. Because what we're really talking about is very simple. Does Congress have the authority mm-hmm. to regulate economic matters?
Right.
The answer is yes. That's the position that the court has taken for the last 75 years. And healthcare makes up 18% mm-hmm. of the economy. So really, is the court going to rule that they can't, that the Congress can't do anything about healthcare? I really don't think so. It doesn't make any sense. And again, they're bound by 75 years of precedent, as well as their own writings and what the Constitution says. And so I think in this instance, they are going to make a decision based on the merits, and they are very sensitive to how the court is perceived. And the last thing they need is a politicized court that looks like it can be bought by the right wing and bow to the politics of the day.
And that was Ethan Rome, who's with Healthcare for America Now. We'll be right back, Truth Seekers.
This building fall. We have watched
one by one.
It's away.
One by one.
That someone tried
one by one
to whisk away.
One by one.
But this school,
one by one,
drenched in shame.
One by one.
Cannot hide
one by one
behind a name.
One by one.
We have age
one by one
against our will.
Against the Flying Monkey Right with Mike Malloy.
Our guest is, this segment is Reverend James Winkler. He is with the United Church of Christ General Board. He was among those arrested last July outside the Capitol building in protest of treatment of the poor. Jim is a member of the Justice and Advocacy Commission of the National Council of Churches of the United States and a member of the Steering Committee of the Campaign for Healthcare Now. He's also a board member of several organizations, including the Faith and Politics Institute, Churches for the Middle East Peace, and Africa Action. Jim, thanks very much for being here. Campaign for Healthcare Now. Tell us what that is.
Mike, the Campaign for Healthcare Now is really a grassroots organization that was started by a wonderful woman named Marilyn Clement, who unfortunately died 2 years ago of cancer. But Marilyn had been a longtime activist and had a vision of bringing together folks from all across the country who are dedicated to a single-payer healthcare system. And that's Campaign for Healthcare Now. They continue to operate, although, of course, we lost the fight on single-payer health care plan in the last Congress. But I actually head up the United Methodist. You mentioned United Church of Christ, United Methodist General Board of Church and Society. And our church, which is comprised of about 7 million United Methodists spread across 35,000 local churches here in the United States, is dedicated to health care for all people. And our general conference, the highest decision-making body of our church, has, in fact, in the past, endorsed a single-payer health care plan.
I was talking with Vince DeMarco earlier. He's been the president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative. And my attitude more aligns with yours about single payer, and if not that, at least a public option that I thought was promised for the American Care Act and was not included. Vince seems to feel that this is single payer is not the direction that we should be going in this country. Now, I disagree with that, but I'm certainly willing to hear and was willing to hear his point of view. Why do you insist that single payer is the way to go?
Well, let me mention that in terms of our church's policies, we do look forward to the day of single payer. But in our statement, we actually said that we'll also accept incremental steps in that direction. I have to tell you, I pray that the health care reform law is the Affordable Choice Act is perhaps over a long term a step in that direction. Mm-hmm. But let me put it this way: when I've spoken to church groups in church basements across the country, I've said, "Have you ever notice when you're on an interstate highway and you're coming near to a medium or large city in this country, you see oftentimes a handful of tall buildings, maybe 15, 20 stories. Then you get into town, you're driving through downtown, and what are those buildings? They're invariably bank and insurance buildings.
Right, right.
I saw the folks, well, so how does an insurance company have the resources to build that building? Well, it's because they take premiums from you and me, and then their whole point is not to pay out.
Right, exactly.
To deny care. So they end up with vast sums of money, which they've got to use in addition to paying their executives tremendous amounts of money. And so they buy real estate and they build these huge buildings. Mm-hmm. It's money that ought to be spent on your health care and mine. So in a single payer system, we'd eliminate that. We'd go from about 25% on the dollar disappearing into the pockets of these companies and instead, we'd be spending about 4 to 6 cents in terms of administration on health care. We'd have a lot more money to take care of all of us. It's a no-brainer to me. It's fascinating to me that in this country, as opposed to other major industrialized nations, we've failed to realize this elementary point.
Well, you know, another thing, and since you are a man of the cloth, I want to bring this up. A lot of the professed Christians on the right seem to be absolutely ignoring the admonition of Jesus, the most essential one. And to me, that was to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit those in prison, and take care of people who are sick. How, I realize you can only speak for yourself, but how in the world do people who profess to be followers of Christ insist on maintaining the status quo that benefits, as you just pointed out, the corporations?
It's a twist, a perversion of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and in fact of the entire scriptures, because in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible is replete with examples of admonitions to rulers to take care of the sick, and warnings, direct warnings that if you don't do this, you lose your legitimacy and you risk your rule. Ezekiel 34:4 is a great example. I've got it, if I may, right here,
sure.
Where it says Ezekiel denounced the leaders of ancient Israel whose failure of responsible government included failure to provide health care. And this is the quote from the scripture: "You have not strengthened the weak, you have not healed the sick, you have not bound up the injured, you have not brought back the strayed, you have not sought the lost, but with force and harshness you have ruled them."
Oh my.
And of course Jesus talks about the Good Samaritan. His whole ministry was a healing ministry. So it's astonishing to me too that Christians lose sight of this, and I believe that and many of them, frankly, their theology is capitalism rather than Christianity. And so in my church, we'll have our major denominational congress, if you will, next month, with United Methodists coming in from all over the country to Tampa, Florida. You're elected to this to be a representative. And there will be numerous petitions to try to delete the sentence that we've had in our social principles for many, many years, which says health care is a human right.
Mm-hmm.
And their argument is health care is not a human right. Well,
oh,
if you kind of follow through on that, what is a human right? Is it a right to have clean water, to have clean air, to have food? And for a lot of Christians now, it's come down to, no, you don't have these rights. And there's almost two ways of looking at life, it seems to me. Either we're all in this together,
mm-hmm.
and we've got to help each other out, which I believe is fundamental to the teachings of Jesus, or you're in it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if you're lucky, you'll have family and friends on your side.
Maybe what Christianity needs right now is a Paul who will write letters not to the Galatians, not to the Thessalonians, but letters to that aspect of the Christian church and point out what the theology is supposed to be.
That's a great point. Because Paul, of course, had to, shall we say, correct the understandings of
mm-hmm.
Of new Christians who came down, like all people, they began to fight with each other over what they thought was the meaning of the teachings of Christ, or about how they take care of their own money, or how they elected their leaders, and so forth. And Paul had to remind them again and again and again of what Christ's teachings were all about. So I agree with you. We need that type of correction for a lot of our sisters and brothers.
What is your gut feeling? I realize this comes under the heading of reading tea leaves. What is your gut feeling that this Supreme Court is going to rule where it concerns the mandate?
Well, I guess your guess is as good as mine. My guess is as good as yours. It will be, I think, a fascinating test for this particular Supreme Court, given its makeup, in that my hunch is that their inclination for at least five of them is to find this to be unconstitutional. At the same time, I think the question has been settled as to whether or not the government has the right to make sure that everybody has health care.
Right.
I mean, the Commerce Clause has been adjudicated in the Supreme Court many, many years ago. And so it's not just a matter of whether or not they'll find this law constitutional, but if they find it unconstitutional, it calls into question many, many, many other things.
Well, that's the part that is worrisome to me. It's no secret that the right, political right in this country, has been trying to undermine the so-called social safety net for decades now. And this is like, you know, when you're a kid and you build a little house of cards, and there's games now where you start out with a structure and you pull this piece and pull this piece and pull this piece, and all of a sudden it all comes down. And what you just described is what I think worries a lot of people of conscience, whether they're religious or not, is that this Supreme Court may have that as an objective to remove, and with this ruling, that would remove whatever protections are left with Medicare and Medicaid. And it's very worrisome. That was the Reverend James Winkler, Campaign for Health Care Now. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. All in my home, I'm going to let it shine. All in my room, I'm going to let it shine, shine. The road is dark, the way was long. Kept on singing that freedom song. My God promised me a rainbow sign. Just gotta let my little light shine. Don't give up. Let it shine on the battlefield.
This hour is being sponsored by Benjamin Kirshner. He says, at times I thought you were a bit too far off political correctness and were hitting a bit low and hard against the other side of the aisle, but every time I try to listen to right-wing American talk radio, I remember what the American liberal middle is up against. So, hit lower, hit harder, and keep it lit. Ben from the Social Democratic Governed Province of Manitoba. Thank you, Ben. I appreciate that. If you've been listening to the program tonight, you know we're coming to you from this madhouse, this broadcast area next to the Supreme Court. And the reason for our being here is to cover the 2 or 3 days of hearings that are going on. We're having a series of guests who we're talking with. Right now we're going to talk with Spike Ward. She is the head of a nonprofit in San Fernando Valley, California. She became a high-profile backer of the law last year when she enrolled in her state's pool after finding out she had breast cancer. Ms. Ward wrote an open letter to Obama, published as an op-ed piece in the L.A. Times, apologizing for initially criticizing the health care overhaul. She had wanted public health care for all Americans. Spike, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It seems kind of weird that you would be apologizing.
Well, did you read, I don't know if you read the op-ed, but
I
had done, okay, I'm a well-known nonprofit leader in Los Angeles, and I had campaigned for Obama originally, and I had bumper stickers on my car, one that said, "Got Hope," with the question mark, and the other one said, "Another Mama for Obama." And when I got mad at the president after I found out that I was going to have to buy health insurance in 2014, and when I quit listening and didn't bother to do any research about the Affordable Care Act, I had taken a Sharpie and I blacked out the top of the question mark and the top of the H so that it said, "Got Nope." So I'm driving around Los Angeles with "Got Nope" on my bumper sticker for a while. So I people know me. And that wasn't very good for the president. So that's on me because I checked out and I didn't do the research that I should have done. So here I am, a person that's literally being saved by the Affordable Care Act. And so I've definitely done my homework.
How is it saving you, your work?
I have stage 3 breast cancer.
Right.
And I found out that I had that at the end of October. We hadn't been insured for 2 years, both as a nonprofit leader, right when the recession hit, people just quit giving to charity. So I had to keep working and running my organization, and I wasn't getting paid. My husband has his own business. He kept working. Nobody was paying him. So because we're entrepreneurs, we were forced to have to buy our insurance through the individual market. Most people don't understand because they've got the insurance through the employers that this is really expensive, and it's not good coverage. And it got to where it was $1,500 a month, and we were using our home equity line to pay for it, thinking it wasn't going to be like this forever and we would make it through. And then Chase Bank cut us off from our home equity line. So here we were, broke. Middle-class America, ordinary people, broke. And now what do? So, of course, we couldn't afford the health insurance anymore, and it was a gamble. We didn't want to, this wasn't the way we were going to go to the, you know, for the rest of our lives. And I found out I had cancer in November. And then I was insured 1st of December through PCIP.
All right, now how does the Affordable Care Act, how is it helping you now?
PCIP is the pre-existing condition insurance plan that's, you know, every state was given some money to open these pools up. So for the people that have been kicked off the individual insurance market, you know, that's me, and my husband had a pre-existing condition. I mean, they can kick you off for anything. So
being born is a pre-existing condition.
That's one of the stories on the Obama. They did, you know, the re-elect Obama had done a video of me that they put up on his website. And one of the other stories that they covered was a little baby that was diagnosed with a pre-existing condition in utero. She had half a heart. She could have not gotten covered before she was born.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, the Affordable Care Act is changing all that. So, literally, it's saving my life. So, I just feel like it's my civic duty to pay it forward and let other people know about what's working.
What happens if this right-wing Supreme Court rules in a couple of months after hearing testimony here the past 2 or 3 days? What if they rule that the individual mandate is unconstitutional? Will that affect you?
It'll affect all of us.
But you know? but with that part.
Sure, because no one's going to give me insurance. But I don't know exactly how this is going to work with PCIP. I don't know that they, you know, throw me to the curb here, because in 2014 is when all this was supposed to go into effect. But yeah, people like me will die, you know?
Would you have, this is kind of an odd question, in, given what you've just said, that it's keeping you alive, but would you have preferred single payer?
Oh, totally. I was all upset. I'm a lefty going, I want my single payer. I'll take the public option if I can't get my... No, I got upset. Now that I've really educated myself on this, given everything that was against this president, it's a miracle that this is what passed. Because you have, he has this, you know... Now that I know over, you know, past 100 years, other presidents have tried to do this and have failed, he pretty much, he put his political career on the line for this. And his only real, the only real opposition were the Republicans. Everybody else was at the table because this whole for-profit system is imploding and everybody knows it. And the Republicans know it, but they just want to take this man down. And that's not what's in best interest of me or you or anybody else
that's
in this country.
That's true. And it's a damn shame that we have a political party in this country that is so determined to get nasty and political when there are people. We're talking about health care here. So it's amazing. Spike, that's it. These are very quick interviews.
Yeah, I understand.
I appreciate you sitting
Thanks
down and talking
with us.
All right, take care. And good luck with the treatment.
Thank you.
All right, take care. That was Spike Ward. Stay with us. More to come on the Molloy Program. Think of this. Conservatives, Republicans, and teabaggers. I'm not Obama's biggest fan either, but considering the alternative, we all need to hold our noses and vote a straight Democratic ticket in November. There's some progressive Democrats. There are no progressive Republicans. Good point, Rochelle. Coming to you from Washington, D.C., where the Affordable Care Act is going through a couple, 3 days of hearings. As the right wing tries to undo the work done by the Congress and the President of the United States where it concerns this act. And in that process of being here in D.C., we're talking to as many folks as we can regarding the plus side of the Health Care Act. And if you've been listening tonight, you know that we have some guests on that are not necessarily in favor of single payer. They're not necessarily in favor of the public option, but... they are pretty much everybody's in agreement that the ACA should remain. Our guest now is Terry Gardner. He directs the Small Business Majority's policy development team and works on long-term strategic planning. He particularly focused on policies that will ensure the successful implementation of ACA, including the establishment of 50 state small business health care exchanges. Terry, welcome to the program. 50 state small business healthcare exchanges. What does that mean to people who don't understand that, like me?
Well, a health insurance exchange is a marketplace, and each state needs to set up a marketplace where an independent body would then deal with all the insurance companies and get them to post their health plans on the exchange site, mm-hmm. and then customers, small business employers, self-employed, and small business owners could go there and shop and find the plan that fits them and their employees.
How does the Affordable Care Act tie in with that exchange idea?
Well, the ACA requires that every state set up a health insurance exchange, and if a state decides they don't want to or won't, then the federal HHS secretary is required to set up an exchange. So every state and plus the District of Columbia will have an exchange. Both an exchange will be in two parts, an exchange, a marketplace for individuals. So this is where individuals would go to shop, the self-employed, the uninsured, mm-hmm. and everybody that's having trouble getting coverage. And small employers would go to the small employer exchange. So there'd be a marketplace created, which would force the insurance companies to compete against each other, because we know this works. The federal government insures 8 million federal government employees and mm-hmm. retirees and their employees through an exchange. And they,
right.
And the insurance companies can't help themselves. They want those 8 million customers, so they compete. So the exchange is going to pool the millions of small business owners and their employees into one marketplace, and insurance companies will want to go there and offer their plans, and this will create competition.
Why does there seem to be so much resistance to this idea from other business, other parts of the business community?
It's politics.
Politics.
It's that simple. Because the exchanges, one of the first exchanges created was by Mayor Giuliani of New York City, the health plan exchange. Very successful. A lot of companies that never could afford insurance, thousands of them get their insurance through the health pass exchange created by Mayor Giuliani.
Mm-hmm.
Mitt Romney, when he was governor, worked with the Democrats and created the Massachusetts Connector. It's an
right.
exchange. There's an exchange run by the Connecticut Bureau of Industries in Connecticut. Thousands of small businesses get their insurance. So this is an old idea. We, like a lot of other business groups, asked Congress to put the exchange into health reform. And this idea had been kicking around a long time, proven to work. So it's a non-controversial idea. It's been supported by Republicans, Democrats, all kinds of think tanks, left, right, center. And the political partisan controversy over health reform has masked this whole
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm. Arguably, single payer would have been a more effective way to provide everybody, Medicare for everybody, whatever it's going to be called, or whatever it might have been called. What is the position of your organization, Small Business Majority, on single payer?
Well, our position is first that health care and the cost of health care is the number one problem facing small businesses, and it's gone on for decades, and we favor a solution.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we did back before the ACA, we polled small businesses all over the country and detailed polls in states like, what do you guys want?
Right.
You know, and so men and women business owners around the country of all sizes and stripes weighed in, scientific polling. And what we learned is many of them supported single payer. Many of them supported a solution similar to what was created in Massachusetts. Some of them favored a voucher system. But the important thing was they favored a solution over doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So our position is, we favor a solution, and, you know, single payer didn't have the support and the votes in Congress, so we couldn't spend our time on something that was not going to happen. So we worked over the 2 years that the ACA was in before Congress there, and we said, hey, small business owners need affordability. We want tax credits. We know exchanges work. We want exchanges. We need insurance reform. Small businesses need protection. They're They're little people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're hurt by pre-existing conditions. There's 22 million self-employed. They go to the individual market. They need protection. Mm-hmm. They pay the most. So we work to get all kinds of different policies in the ACA to support small businesses so they could be successful.
You know, the obviously, the first word in ACA is affordable. How would what you're suggesting or what you're advocating for, how would it be kept affordable? Because the cost of health care just keeps spiraling, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but how would it remain affordable?
Well, number one, the exchanges create competition long term, and that's one of the ways you're going to control costs. But there are a lot of provisions for cost containment in the Affordable Care Act. And again, this doesn't really get in the media because it's, you know, mm-hmm. not politically popular to right. talk about that. But, you know, we know there's a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid. Study after study has pointed out. So there's a whole set of provisions that go after reducing the waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid, which have helped jack up the insurance rate because that kind of creates a benchmark mm-hmm. in the for our healthcare system. There's also a section, again, it doesn't get any attention on giving funding to states for medical malpractice reforms uh-huh. and letting each state do those. The another provision that's been implemented now and will be more fully implemented later is the medical loss ratio. This puts a lid on how much insurance companies can keep out of that premium dollar and says that 85% of that premium dollar that we're all paying actually flows to doctors, hospitals, and medical providers for medical care.
There's going to be a lot of resistance on that one.
Well, again, you know, it's crazy because some states have already done this, mm-hmm. so it's not like radical. It's proven to work, and guess what? The insurance companies are doing just fine living under that. But, you know, I was a business owner for over 30 years. I'll make whatever I can. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, the profit drive. But normally competition kind of keeps a lid on that. I can't make too much money because I got 10 other competitors and we can't help ourselves from competing, right? Mm-hmm. If Apple charges too much for an iPhone, then people will undercut it and come in with a new product. Well, but we don't have that dynamic really working in the insurance industry for healthcare. And so we need some other things to control it.
That was Terry Gardner, who directs the Small Business Majority's policy development team. Stick around, there's still more to come. Get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run.
This morning in Washington. Neera, thanks for being here. Just right up front, why the Affordable Care Act in the way it was written and not with the public option and not without at least a push for single payer?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the challenge on the single payer issue is, you know, while many of us would support a single payer option, the challenge we have is that, you know, we have a healthcare system that's an employer-based system that grew up after World War II, and you know, the vast majority of Americans really like their health care system and don't like their health care plans and don't like change. So, though we're, as the president has said himself, we're starting over again from the beginning. We, you know, single payer option would be something that I would support personally, but you know, we're not starting off from the beginning. And the challenge we have is that you have to build on the system we have in order to get change. We've tried for decades to accomplish health care reform for all Americans. We failed decade after decade. Here's an opportunity to create, build on the current system, but create a system for those who don't have health insurance. And we took that opportunity to pass this important bill. And I would say on the public option for states that want to experiment with a public option and their exchanges, they're allowed to do so. And Vermont will be a test case, I hope. And you know, if Vermont is showing that a public option works and lowers prices, then you'll see, hopefully, you know, other states take that option up.
How confident do you feel this administration is that the Supreme Court is, given its political makeup, the Supreme Court is not going to rule against the mandate?
Well, the issue is that if you look at actually the language that these justices themselves have used in previous cases that are relevant to this, you should have a 7-2 decision or at least a 6-3 decision. You know, there's two, this isn't a fight between liberals and conservatives. It's actually a fight between two visions of conservatism. One is a Tea Party libertarian perspective that believes that the federal government has very little ability to do anything and can't, you know, this is a very basic form of commerce. And if the government can't regulate this form of commerce, healthcare, which is 1/6 of our economy, then there's very little it can do. And so there's that, you know, I call revolutionary view, radical view. And then there's the more traditional conservative view, which is that the court should show deference to the executive and judicial branch. That, you know, it's ironic to me because conservatives have been arguing for decades that liberals are the ones who have taken on this activist position. Now you've seen with Citizens United, Bush v. Gore, a whole range of cases, them wading into limiting the power, but intervening with the power of the Congress and the executive branch. But in this case, it would be, you know, one of the, it would be sort of, we've never seen a case like this since the Lochner era of really judicial activism. And so I think the courts, you know, I say to my conservative friends, not that I have a million of them, but I say to my conservative friends, do you really want the courts litigating out what can be in and what can't be in a health care bill that's so complicated? I mean, that's really making judges legislators, something that the conservatives have argued against for decades, and that's what's at stake at this bill, in this decision that they're making, that they will make in the next few months.
How do you answer a critic who might say that the ACA simply provides a huge pool of uninsured Americans to the insurance industry, which is not known for really wanting to deliver health care but wanting to make a profit? How do you respond to that criticism?
I completely hear. I'd say, you know, there's a few very important protections in the ACA, something called medical loss ratios, which ensure that private systems for everybody, private health insurance companies for everybody, have to use 80% of their premium for taking care of people. It really limits their excessive profits. And we're already seeing in a bunch of different states that rule is driving down lower costs for the American people. They've reduced premium increases because of the MLR.
And that was Neera Tanden, president of the Center for American Progress and counselor to the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Stay with us. More to come.
We'll be right back. days. It's always gonna be a delicacy. So lick your chops and eat the meat.
Management. Back to Mike Malloy.
Being sponsored by Rochelle, who says, I despise conservatives, Republicans, and teabaggers. I'm not Obama's biggest fan, but considering the alternative, we all need to hold our noses, vote a straight Democratic ticket in November. There are some progressive Democrats. There are no progressive Republicans. Thanks, Rochelle. We're talking with Dr. Alice Chen. She's the executive director of Doctors for America. It's an internal medicine. She is an internal medicine hospitalist and an assistant professor at UCLA. Her passion for health advocacy comes from the patients she meets who suffer for lack of access to care. And her work with Doctors for America is inspired by the colleagues she meets from every corner of the country who are driven to devote their time to being part of the solution. Dr. Chen, thanks for being here. Part of the solution, is the solution the Affordable Care Act, or is it something more comprehensive?
Sure. The Affordable Care Act is a major first step. There is definitely more that needs to be done in the future, but the Affordable Care Act is going to insure 32 million more people. It's making health insurance more secure for everybody who currently is insured. It focuses on prevention, and it's making it easier for doctors to take better care of our patients.
What is the most critical aspect of that you see, you practice as well as advocate? Is
yes,
that correct?
That's correct.
What is the most critical aspect of the lack of health insurance that you see in your practice?
You know, I take care of patients in the hospital who have come into the hospital because they got sick enough to need hospital care.
Right.
And all too often, I see patients who we do everything we can in the hospital to take good care of them, make them feel better, and get them back on their feet to go back home to their families. But if they have no insurance, they can't afford the medications they need or the doctors they need to see when they leave the hospital so they can stay healthy. Mm-hmm. So they come on back to the hospital. And that's heartache for them, and it's cost for the system.
How much stress is that not having health insurance putting on, for example, UCLA Medical Center, I guess would be a good one to use as an example, or any hospital? How much longer can hospitals absorb this cost that health insurance would take care of?
Well, the problem is that the cost is absorbed not only by the hospitals, it is absorbed by taxpayers, by people who have insurance. Everybody is absorbing that cost.
Mm-hmm.
In the state of California, we have $8 billion in care that's not paid for by insurance.
Yearly?
Yearly.
$8
billion. $8 billion.
How does the state of California deal with that?
Well, that is being taken care of by hospitals that are funded by tax money.
Mm-hmm.
It's being taken care of by people who have insurance who end up having to pay more for their insurance because somebody needs to pay for that MRI for that patient who
right.
really needed it.
How, just speaking as an individual physician, how would your ability to practice medicine be affected, if at all, if you knew that the patient you're working with has comprehensive coverage so he or she could get the kind of care needed? How would that influence not diagnosis so much, but treatment plans?
Honestly, it affects diagnosis and treatment plans.
It
affects what tests I can order. It affects what specialists they can see. It affects what medicines they can take and what treatments they can have. It makes it very stressful for doctors to take care of patients who have no insurance because we have to think about not only what is best according to what we know and the science, but also we have to weigh that with whether or not our care is going to bankrupt our patients.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, if you can make this assessment, do physicians, generally speaking, across the country, favor some sort of comprehensive health care? I know that the AMA, if I'm not mistaken, has. I guess they have changed their position, but I know at one time AMA was against the idea of anything remotely resembling single payer. The book bugaboo being, oh, it's socialized medicine.
Right.
What is the position of AMA now, if you know, and what's the position of generally speaking of physicians around the country?
Well, all I know is that the AMA has been supportive of the Affordable Care Act. They were supportive during the course of passing it, and they continue to be supportive of it. They definitely see more that needs to be done. But they have been supportive. And so have some of the major medical organizations, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American College of Physicians, which is all the internal medicine doctors like me.
Mm-hmm.
They have all supported this reform because ultimately the Affordable Care Act is moving us forward very much from where we are right now. As for single payer, I think there are groups that certainly feel that is the only route to go. Our organization, and I believe that we need help for people now, whatever we can get. Ensuring 32 million people is going to make a huge difference to our society, to our communities, to families, to individuals. It's something that we need to do.
We hear a lot about healthcare crisis. Healthcare delivery crisis. How critical, in your opinion, is the situation right now? Are we at a tipping point where if something is not maintained, this would be the ACA that goes into effect, I guess for most people, another year and a half.
Right.
Are we at a tipping point where if this is defeated through the courts, that we're going to have a crisis that nobody can really comprehend?
I mean, to be honest, as a practicing doctor, seeing the tragedies that I see in the current system, it's already something that I can't comprehend. We're already there in many ways. Yes, we have some great medicine in this country. We have some great hospitals, great doctors. But the number of people who are suffering because they can't get health care is un-American.
How would this crisis then affect... If something isn't done, and I hate to fall back on a cliche like that, but if something isn't done, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say here. It's just from what I have read, we are on the cusp of a potential of a real national health disaster.
Absolutely.
Immunizations, preventive care, diagnostic care. All of this stuff is kind of hanging. We have 330 million people here. For example, bird flu. If some sort of virus would get into the general population, given what we have now as healthcare, what are we looking at?
Yeah, we're looking at a system that's increasingly fragmented, where more and more people are uninsured, where more and more people are getting care that's not coordinated. They're not able to get... All of the science that we've done, all of the research, all of the amazing work that the NIH has funded is not actually getting to regular people. It's a crisis in health, and it's certainly a crisis for the country as a whole. The amount of money that we're spending on healthcare without getting the results that we should is something that we absolutely have to address.
Why is this not recognized or acknowledged by that political faction in this country who's putting up so much resistance? For example, the state or states that have brought this suit before the Supreme Court. Why is this not recognized? If doctors recommend it, if public health officials recognize this, why is it not recognized by the right wing?
Well, to be honest, I think it's all become much more political than it ought to. Healthcare is something that affects all of us, and all of us need to work together to fix it. And it's interesting because despite these lawsuits, there are 48 states that applied for grants to set up state insurance exchanges, which is a major cornerstone of the health reform law.
Mm-hmm.
And 33 of those states are moving forward and making significant progress in setting up their state exchanges. So even though the political word is that they don't like this, that this is not what they want, they're actually moving forward.
It must be very frustrating as a physician to see politics enter into medicine.
It is very frustrating.
Not just from the standpoint of working with your patients, but also just overall knowing that a decision that needs to be made on a medical basis has got to take into consideration a political aspect.
For sure. I mean, I listen to these sound bites, and all I can think is those words could mean that somebody is going to die.
Well,
because
yeah.
This health reform, if it goes away, people are going to die. That's what I keep thinking to myself. How could we let this happen in this country?
Well, that's to me, that's the $64 trillion question. How could something like this occur here? I'll tell you, I'm lost. I am totally lost, Dr. Jen. I ricochet between frustration and anger and fear and doubt and then back to anger again. Like, what are we talking about here? We're talking about medicine. We're talking about science. We're not talking about politics. Why is
exactly.
this not removed? You just heard Alice Chen, Executive Director of Doctors for America. More to come. Stay with me. Conservatives, Republicans, teabaggers. I'm not Obama's bigger fan either, but considering the alternative, we all need to hold our noses and vote a straight Democratic ticket in November. There are some progressive Democrats. There are no progressive Republicans. Thank you, Rochelle. Are you Max?
Mike, I'm not. My name is Al Guida.
Al Guida.
Yes, sir.
All right.
I hope you won't hold it against me. I'm a lobbyist. I'm actually a healthcare lobbyist.
Not at all. Max, Mel Guida.
Al Guida.
Al.
Alfonso, Al to my friends.
Al
yes,
Guida.
Sir.
Al Guida, thank you very much for jumping in here.
My pleasure, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Our guest, Max Richmond, Rickman, apparently is otherwise involved. All right, Al Guida, you're a lobbyist.
Yes, sir.
To a lot of people, that's like saying, hi, I'm a demon. What do you lobby for?
Well, Mike, there are white hat lobbyists and black hat lobbyists. I'm a white hat lobbyist,
yeah.
So I represent mostly persons with serious mental illnesses, community mental health centers, the state mental health agencies, occupational therapists.
How does the Affordable Care Act impact those agencies or organizations or businesses that you lobby for?
Hugely. So it turns out that there are a lot of people with very serious mental disorders in the United States that do not have health insurance.
They're all Republican, too, I think.
Well, many of them are, you know, maybe Republicans, but certainly Democrats.
No, I shouldn't make a joke about that, but I get very upset and very angry about the right-wing resistance to this.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, it's quite all right. So, the estimate I have is that one in three people that will receive health insurance under the ACA have either a serious mental disorder or an addiction disorder or both.
Mm-hmm.
So these are folks that, you know, the practical impact to your listeners is that these are individuals that right now are on the streets of major American cities. About 20% of people in penitentiaries are people with oftentimes untreated mental illnesses. So there would be a significant societal benefit if we provided these individuals with the health care they needed so that they could, you know, mm-hmm. receive their mental health care by one of my clients as opposed to getting it either in an emergency room or in a van as they lie in a, mm-hmm. on a park bench in major American cities across the country. Mike.
I have read many articles recently about how the American prison system is turning into a dumping ground for people with mental health problems.
Yes.
People who violate the law and do so. I'm not cutting anybody any slack here, but people who violate the law because of an underlying addiction or mental problem.
Yeah.
And then they wind up in a situation that can only exacerbate and terrify people who already are mentally ill.
Yeah, exactly the case.
How does the ACA or how would that impact that? Or maybe you've already answered it.
Well, here's the thing. So just what you've described is the reinstitutionalization phenomenon. These individuals used to be served in large public state psychiatric hospitals. Now some of them are served in state and county prisons and federal penitentiaries. So the provision of health insurance will actually provide a stable source of psychiatric and related mental health services for that population.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, if we are able to better control these conditions, then we can keep them out of law enforcement, keep them off the street, and perhaps even provide some chance of recovery for this population.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, in the absence of health insurance, again, in many instances, these folks find themselves in emergency psychiatric facilities, on the street, or in contact with law enforcement. So the societal cost is large, and in many instances, we're talking about personal tragedies for millions of Americans.
Most of the people that we've been talking to during this program, I presented the same statement or question. I don't understand why there is any resistance to affordable health care when, you know, my grandmother used to say an ounce of prevention is worth 10 tons of cure,
Yeah. Especially
what you're talking about here.
Yeah.
Mental health problems that don't get better. I mean, it's not like having poison ivy that goes away or a headache. You can take a Bufferin. Mental health problems and addiction problems. Why, in your opinion, is there so much resistance?
You know, Mike, you have to assume here that a lot of it just animus towards President Obama. That the infrastructure of this legislation, as many of your guests may have pointed out, was actually endorsed in the 90s, reduced the legislation by Republican leaders in the Senate.
Right.
And matter of fact, the concept was actually produced by the
Heritage Foundation,
which is a right-wing think tank that's located about five blocks from where you and I are sitting right now.
Mm-hmm.
So literally, and so the individual mandate, in fact, was literally produced by the Heritage Foundation,
right,
line for line, word for word. So I suspect that when President Obama, in an effort to generate bipartisan support for the legislation, in an effort to reach out to Republicans, endorsed this concept as a means of extending health insurance, then that became the kiss of death. His endorsement generated this enormous backlash among what became the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and my God, what a tragedy. Because, the hope is that we can have rational conversations about all kinds of policies, education policy, transportation policy, healthcare mm-hmm. policy, and that rational conversation appears to be impacted by what is unreasoning animus towards the president.
It's really, you used the right word, it really is a tragedy. When I think during the Clinton years, where Bill Clinton got a lot of legislation passed, and arguably good, bad, or indifferent, but because he adopted and co-opted Republican ideas, this president, as you just pointed out, tried to do something similar where it concerns this issue, and they're just
lashing him. And that was Al Guida, Truth Seekers, an honest-to-God lobbyist, only one of the good ones. Stick around, more to come after the break at the top of the hour. Stay with us, I'm Mike Malloy. As we broadcast from Washington, D.C., not too far from the Supreme Court building, the Affordable Care Act is under assault. Joining us now is Tom Perriello. Is that how you pronounce it?
Well done, sir.
Tom Perriello, who is a former U.S. representative from Virginia's 5th Congressional District. He served from 2009 to 2011. He is, of course, a Democrat. He is currently serves as president and CEO of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. That's a progressive, most of our audience knows, progressive think tank dedicated to improving the lives of Americans through ideas and action. Tom, what? Let's just start with what you think the chances are that the Supreme Court will not declare the mandate unconstitutional, given the political makeup of this court.
I would be shocked if they overturned the constitutionality of this bill. It's so clearly rooted in the Constitution and in precedent. Nothing shocks me in this town anymore. Obviously, they you know, found a way to support the Citizens United decision, so anything's possible. But you know, this really comes down to the intent of the founders. When you think about the language that was in the Constitution that was not in the Articles of Confederation, the argument the conservatives are making is not about the U.S. Constitution. It's about the Articles of Confederation that was rejected by the founders because the Articles of Confederation were too weak. Mm-hmm. There was no interstate commerce clause.
Right.
George Washington said that was so weak that it almost cost us the Revolutionary War. So these founders understood the importance of having some role for a federal government, particularly when you're talking about something that involves one-seventh of the U.S. economy and every single family that lives in every state in the United States. So it would be a tremendous act of rejecting the Constitution were they to rule this bill unconstitutional. I would love to see a 6-3 decision rather than a 5-4. But again, I can't know what's in their minds and hearts right now.
Given the rhetoric, anyway, from the political right in this country, they are such... they uphold the Constitution. By uphold, I mean they hold it up in their hands. I don't mean they uphold it, but they hold it up in their hands, and they scream about Constitution and go back to the original intent of the framers. And yet, as you just pointed out, the original intent of the framers was for a strong, in certain areas, a strong federal government to take care of these issues that have to be taken care of. They can't be done on a state-by-state basis. So, stupid question here, but why do you suppose that so many people on the political right don't recognize their own argument, I guess. Wow.
Never in my life have so many people recommended it, that I read a book that they clearly had never written themselves when they would offer me copies of the Constitution. And I think people want to argue for the Constitution they wish we had instead of the one we do have. And again, we've tried it twice in my part of the country. We tried it with the Articles of Confederation, and we tried it with the Confederate States of America. And in both cases, you had the language of a union that was not strong enough to stand. So I think if you believe in the importance of public health legislation, for example, you don't want each state to be able to sell out in a race to the bottom. We would look like China today in terms of public health and pollution and poisoning of our air and water if we didn't have the ability to say, no, we're going to set clean air and clean water standards for the entire country so that states aren't forced to make that race to the bottom decision. So why do people go the other way? You know, I think there's, first of all, we're a pluralistic country. People are entitled to their opinions, which is great. They're not entitled to their own facts. And one of the things about the Constitution was that Jefferson and others, Madison, etc., wrote something that could continue to live through centuries and improve. One of the most important promises of this country, for example, is the idea of a more perfect union. We are a more perfect union than we were then, in part because they had at least the vision, even with their flaws, to understand eternal principles. So women have the right to vote now. We've dealt with civil rights and slavery and other issues, at least to a great extent. And these are steps forward. So I think what you see here, you see judges like Judge Silberman, who got the Medal of Freedom from George W. Bush. This is a hardcore conservative saying there is no basis in either the text of the Constitution or Supreme Court precedent for overruling this law. Judge Harvey Wilkinson down in my part of the country, incredibly respected conservative judge, similarly saying this is a political case, not an actual constitutional case in many ways. So, you know, you have a genuine policy debate we can have. Is it a good idea for everyone to have health insurance or not? Is it good to have a more competitive market where insurance companies have to spend at least 80% of their money on people's care? Is it fair to have a system where working and middle-class folks pay over $1,000 more a year for premiums because other people didn't have insurance? And it's not like those people are just freeloading. They're getting the worst care, which is the emergency room care, the most expensive care, instead of preventative care. So, you know, this is a system that makes sense. Unfortunately, we don't have a mainstream media that makes a lot of sense, and we're coming back at this a second and third time. But I'll say one other thing. People are now, ironically, because of the contraception fight, finally starting to see that there's some good stuff in the bill that they didn't necessarily believe before. Once they know that the Republicans are trying to take away their access to free health care and saying that a judge or your employer can come in and tell you whether to get birth control or not, people are now looking back at the bill and saying, wait a second, this thing guarantees pre- and postnatal care for women? If you're a young working family trying to decide when to start a family and whether you can afford it, access to birth control matters a lot, and knowing that you're not going to get socked with thousands and thousands of dollars in pre- and postnatal care makes a big difference. So I think people are looking back at this now that the Republicans want to take it away and saying, wait a second, I don't want you to take that away. Not to mention, under the Republican plan, Medicare starts to go insolvent in 4 years.
Right.
4 years. Or I guess it's 5 years. It's 2017.
Now. Well, you know, when you mention, and a lot of people do mention this, that there can be policy differences. We live in a pluralistic society and so on and so on and so on. And yet, when those differences are not based in any kind of logic or reason or anything remotely resembling the best way forward for the entire society, how do you grant the other side, so to speak, an equal soapbox, an equal footing? This is the crazy part to me.
Well, I think granting everyone a chance to be heard is not crazy at all. I think assuming that people somehow have truth in their claims just because they're
speaking,
that's
the qualifier,
is a different story. And I, you know, my hope is that this is a case where the Supreme Court will perform exactly the function it failed to do in Bush v. Gore. In Bush v. Gore, We needed people to rise above politics in one institution and be able to move the country forward.
Right.
And instead, you had a decision where conservative judges used liberal jurisprudence
right.
in order to put a Republican
right.
in office. Here you have a question. You have a great opportunity for the Supreme Court to restore people's confidence, not because they come down one way or the other on the law,
mm-hmm.
but by sticking to the law, sticking to the Constitution. It would be an incredibly powerful statement to the American people that there is an institution that is going to do its duty and is going to take seriously that integrity. We haven't seen enough of that, and so we're left with these kinds of conversations. But in the meantime, 85 million Americans since the bill passed have gotten some form of free preventative care, including millions of women getting mammograms mm-hmm. and other services. 2.5 million young Americans have been able to stay on their parents' plan. Tens of thousands of Americans with pre-existing conditions, that most horrific of circumstances for a family, are able to get insurance now.
Providing with you a whole parade of folks who are from the progressive or the Democratic or the liberal side of this equation where it concerns the Affordable Care Act that is being argued in front of the Supreme Court over the next couple of days, and then a decision as to the constitutionality of the mandate will come from that court. Joining us now is Bill Bentley. He's the president and CEO of Voices for America's Children. Bill has devoted his life to building a world where every kid has the opportunity to thrive. He leads Voices for America's Children, a national advocacy network that speaks out for children on Capitol Hill, in state legislatures, and in city halls. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
That's quite an undertaking, arguably one of the most neglected segments of the American population are our kids.
Absolutely.
How important is the decision from the Supreme Court on the ACA where it concerns children?
Extremely important. If they do anything but uphold that law, they put 7 to 8 million kids, for example, who would receive health care because of the Medicaid expansion
mm-hmm.
at great risk of not having health care. And one of the many problems in doing that is that a great many of those kids are poor kids and kids of color. That, I think, is one of many reasons why the court needs to do the right thing for kids in this
mm-hmm.
country.
How have we gotten to a point, Bill, where
the needs of children, and not just medical needs, but nutritional needs and educational needs, stability needs, support needs, have just been shuffled into a category that's almost off the chart. How did this happen? I'm just curious. I mean, what happened?
I think what happened was lobbyists who make lots of money are able to convince policymakers through their resource allocation that their issues are much more important than anything else. We as child advocates, we don't have that. We don't have a whole lot of money to give to people's campaigns. What we have is a passion for kids and believing that kids deserve better in this country than what they're getting. To a large degree, I think it's not Democrat, it's not Republican. I think policymakers in general are not saying a whole lot about kids. If you think back to the most recent Republican debates and those that have happened over the last several months, they've only mentioned children 2% of the time. We've done a report we released about 2 weeks ago.
I'm surprised it's that high.
You and me both, but there's one thing to remember. They get credit for talking about children when they say, we don't want to leave our children with debt. Or when they say, every child needs a good education. There's no real substance there.
No.
So we don't really count it, but in order to be fair, we wanted to point out that at least they said that. We've kind of lost our way, I think, as a country. We talk about wanting a workforce for the 21st century, but we forget where that workforce is going to come from. Our kids can't read. Right now, only a third of our kids are proficient in reading and math. There's something wrong with that. So where is the workforce coming from?
Part of that has to tie into health care and nutrition.
Absolutely.
If you have kids that haven't got their vaccinations,
right.
If you have kids that don't regularly get checkups to find out if they've got some low-level virus, and that shows up in the classroom as low performance, and then everybody starts screaming at the teachers.
Right, exactly. We act surprised.
It's madness. It is madness.
It is. A kid who's sick is not going to learn. A kid who is hungry is not going to learn. I grew up in the projects in Liberty City in Miami, and I was fortunate. My mom worked three jobs. One of those jobs happened to be for a general practitioner on Miami Beach. He provided me with my health care because he came to like my mom and she him, and they became friends. Getting health care shouldn't be dependent on who you know or where you live. At the same time, I got good health care. My mom's sister and her seven kids went to a public county health department and were treated pretty poorly. And being dependent on other people to ensure that you've got good health care is really not a good place for people to be.
No, it's not the way to go. Bill Bentley, CEO and President of Voices for America's Children, I hope this argument in front of the Supreme Court turns out in a sensible way because, as you point out, we're talking about our future.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, sir. I appreciate
you
being
Mike.
Here.
Appreciate what you're doing.
Okay, take care.
You
appreciate
too.
It. Quick break here. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Did you wake up?
Doing talk radio right from the left. It's Michael Long.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
5 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored, by the way, by Paul McCormick. His message, stupidity should be painful to the afflicted or possibly fatal. Joining us now is former Congress. God, I hate to say that. Former Congressman.
No, I'm still in Congress.
You're still in Congress.
Till January 3rd.
Dennis Kucinich, who is was my candidate for president a couple of years ago. And as a special guest, we didn't have you scheduled, Dennis, but I'm glad to see you here. Why are you here?
I was very active in that health care debate, Mike, and have been right from the time I first came to Congress. I'm the co-author of H.R. 676, Universal Single-Payer Not-for-Profit Healthcare
right.
System. And because of my position, I became centrally involved in the debate towards the end of affordable care as to whether or not we could even have a public option.
Mm-hmm.
I pushed through a committee vote the ability of states to be able to have to set up a single-payer plan. And that still stands, the amendment I got through committee, as a sign of the viability of single payer down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But this bill right now, which is being heard, the arguments heard at the Supreme Court, will determine whether or not Congress has the power to even regulate insurance companies. Will determine whether or not insurance companies will have carte blanche to keep jacking up the rates
mm-hmm.
and sending people into bankruptcy. So it is important that we uphold this bill, and if it's not upheld, then we have to start the effort for single payer all over again.
Given the so many things in this country right now politically that really suck, first of all, the hard right that has so much influence on what happens, whether it's media or in the Congress and the Supreme Court, what is your best guess as to what's going to happen? I realize this is a tea leaf reading, but your best guess as to what's going to happen, given the political nature of this court, and it is political.
Well, if the court strikes down the individual mandate, then we're looking at, I suppose, the whole bill going down. Because they didn't have a clause that would say you can keep one part of it going if another part of the bill is deemed to be not legally viable. But I will tell you that if the court were to strike down any essential part of the bill, we go right back to the single payer argument.
Mm-hmm.
That would actually, paradoxically, I might add, be the worst thing that could happen for the health insurance companies, because right now they have a captive audience.
Right.
They don't even want to be regulated, though, while the audience is captive. They just want to put us in a form of peonage to insurance companies who are driving the increase in health care, so where it's like three times the rate of inflation right now, the increased costs in health care, where insurance company profits are going through the roof. Even in the interim period between the beginning of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and today, they're performing better than a Standard & Poor's 500 index.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's happening is that this debate over at the Supreme Court enables us to start the discussion all over again in America. If the court upholds the law, then Congress did the right thing and has the ability to enact legislation that would regulate the insurance industry. If they don't uphold it, then we've got to go back to single payer. And frankly, that'll be the only way we can control the insurance companies, which is to say there shouldn't be for-profit health care in America. There should only be not-for-profit health care in America.
But given the reality of how hard the right lobbied against single payer, even though single payer was not even an issue, given how hard the right lobbied against the public option, if the Supreme Court does strike this down, what possible hope would even discussion for single payer have?
The insurance company spent $86 million trying to defeat the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want any control at all.
Right.
It goes back to who are we as a country? What do we feel about being an American in terms of what are our basic rights? Does government have a moral
mm-hmm.
responsibility to provide for the health care of its people? Or are we all just here as workers on a health insurance plantation? So we have a moment here in time where if the court rules against it, we have to reorganize the country and start a push for a national health care system and empower those states that are pushing for national health care, states like Vermont, states like California, to make it happen at a state level once one province enacted it in Canada, a not-for-profit care, you saw inevitably all the provinces jumped in.
What are the chances of the American public understanding how critical this issue is? You can make the argument that a lot of people media have provided total misinformation, disinformation, or flat-out lies. Is there time for an education process?
Well, let's do it right now. I mean, if you have a young person, age 26 or under, under this bill, dependent coverage is extended to them. If you have a child under 19 years of age, they cannot be denied insurance and benefits based on pre-existing condition. If you have a serious illness, insurance companies cannot put a cap on the amount of dollars that would be expended for for your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
If you're interested in preventive care, the plans have to cover preventive care with no cost sharing. There has to be an appeals process for coverage and claims. Right now, what's the appeals process? You stay on the phone for hours and hours, and no one answers.
Right.
And they just try to roll you so you can't get coverage. And finally, this bill provided some controls on the amount of money that goes for administrative costs and says you can't exceed.
Mm-hmm.
Your administrative costs can only go to a certain extent in connection with your medical costs. So, look, there are so many benefits there. Is the bill perfect? No. But it showed that we're capable of bringing about some reform, and it will help people.
All right. You were an ardent advocate for single payer, as was and am I. Do you suggest, then, that people on the progressive left support the ACA as it's currently written, get behind this bill as a means of moving the argument forward?
Well, that's why I voted for it, Mike. It's a transition.
Right.
I don't see this bill as a destination. It's a stop along the way. It shows that reform within the context of a for-profit system is possible.
Because
let's say it didn't happen. We would not have been able to prove that we can pass any kind of health care reform bill.
Mm-hmm.
But having passed this, and also having passed in committee a bill that provided for states to have a mechanism to move towards single payer, we've changed the argument. I want a not-for-profit system. But this is a step along the way. We cannot concede to the insurance companies any more ground. We cannot let the insurance companies continue to control every aspect of debate. To tell us on one hand, we don't want to be regulated. We don't want to have to provide... Right. For pre-existing conditions. We don't have to want to give young people under 26 coverage under their parents' policy. We don't want to have to put we don't want to have to be exposed to paying more and more if someone's sicker and sicker. If we can't control these insurance companies, they own us.
Right.
This is really what it amounts to. On the other hand, if we can have some controls now, we can hope that the insurance companies' hold on our political process will be somewhat weakened, and that can enable us to catapult towards a not-for-profit system someday.
Let me see if I can get a 30-second answer out of you. Given all the criticality of what you're talking about, how important is it to have a Congress who understands this rather than a Congress that is a political driven or ideologically driven the way this
one is? We need a Congress that understands it, but we need a Congress that's independent enough to be able to vote for the interests of their constituents,
right.
Which is why I have another bill, House Joint Resolution 100, that would outlaw private funding of elections. The core issue we have in this country is these interest groups can drive the political agenda because they keep investing in politicians and in political parties. So we have to get money out of the political process, then we can reclaim the country. People need information on that, Mike. They can go to my website at Kucinich.us. It's great to be on with you.
Thanks,
and I'm so it's so good to see you again.
Last time, Seattle. We're in Seattle with Molly.
Yes.
Molly's still waiting to come to Congress.
Oh, great.
And
well, I'll look forward to it.
And why'd you do
you
things?
Let me know.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks again.
I appreciate it. Dennis Kucinich, I feel like a jerk, former member of Congress. He's not a former member. He was pushed out by John Kasich machine in Ohio. Rat bastards. All right, we're going to take a break here and come back. We have one more guest this evening, Bob Edgar, who's the president of Common Cause. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Well, I'm Mike Malloy.
You gotta keep talking for another few seconds.
All right, here we go. Stay with us.
Being sponsored by Paul McCormick. His message, stupidity should be painful to the afflicted. Amen and amen. Joining us now is Bob Edgar. He is the president of Common Cause. He also served 12 years in Congress. He was a general secretary, in addition, of the National Council of the Churches of Christ in the USA for 7 years immediately before arriving at Common Cause. He represented the 7th Congressional District of Pennsylvania, just outside Philly. Bob was part of the congressional class nicknamed the Watergate Babies. Remember that? Those elected in the wake of the Watergate scandal who led sweeping reforms of Congress. He served 6 terms. Bob, thanks for being here. It just seems so quaint now to think about Watergate and what that was all about, and then take a look at the political atmosphere today. It's amazing.
Watergate was actually the progressive Tea Party event where 75 Democratic freshmen, 17 Republicans came in and started to reform Congress. We unseated 5 Democratic committee chairs within the first weeks of our service who were there only by seniority but not by competency. Mm-hmm. People like Wilbur Mills, who had fallen into the water basin. We also shut down the Vietnam War. We were the first group of Congress people who came passionately to end the war in Vietnam and work on things like the first energy bill. Mm-hmm. But things have changed. The world has gotten much more partisan, much more conservative. When I served in Congress, my best friends were moderate Republicans like Senator Jake Javits, right. Senator Brooks of Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Senator Hines and Schweiker of Pennsylvania. Those days have disappeared, and I think in large measure by organizations, Newt Gingrich's Contract on America, a number of elected officials come to Washington with narrow vision of the world, and it's frustrating for those of us who want elected officials to serve the public interest and not the special interest.
And that narrow vision so often is just so negative. A Common Cause's interest in maintaining the intactness of the Affordable Care Act, especially where it concerns the mandate. What is that interest to Common Cause?
Well, our interest is actually deeper than that. We're concerned that money is corroding our democracy and that billions of dollars were spent by the health care industry, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the drug companies, to water down the health care legislation. And we think that government should be of and by and for the people, not of and by and for large corporations. We think this bill is not the best health care bill ever, but it's a good start. We know history. Remember when Social Security was put in place, not everybody liked Social Security.
Right.
But even some of the Tea Party folks now say, get government off my back and out of my pocketbook, but don't cut my Social Security check. 25, 30 years from now, I believe ultra-conservatives who want less government are going to say, get government off our backs, but keep our health care legislation in place.
I would like to think that ultra-conservatism will have either disappeared or moderated into something that is more sane 20 or 30 years from now.
Yeah, let me just say a word about that. It was Dr. Martin Luther King, who I met 5 weeks before he was assassinated, who said this. He said, you and I will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of bad people, but for the appalling silence of good people. I think it's time for good people to take back democracy, to occupy democracy, to say that the Founding Fathers intended that people rule, not money ruling, not corporations ruling. Common Cause has just launched a campaign to amend the Constitution to make it clear that legislative bodies can limit money in politics, that corporations are important, but they're not people, and money is important, but it can stifle speech as well as provide speech.
That's quite an agenda. I mean, we can walk 25 feet outside the door of this building and see people on the street demonstrating in favor of gutting or destroying totally the Affordable Care Act. This is a part that just makes me get a little bit dizzy and crazy and want to start screaming.
I think many of those people walking and demonstrating have not read the legislation, don't know what the legislation can do, and have been propagandized by hate speech over the last 2 years. And I think it's important for average ordinary citizens to push back on that and perhaps get some of those protesters against health care to fully understand the texture of what is in fact in the bill and what it means for 20 to 30 million Americans to be covered by health care who currently are outside the health care system.
I hope that's not too optimistic a goal, trying to get people to understand that it makes no sense to work against their own best economic or in this case, interests where it concerns health care. And it just seems that it just seems like there is such a know-nothing attitude in this country. I hope it disappears. Bob Edgar, president of Common Cause, I appreciate your stopping by.
It was great to be with you, and keep your voice of justice.
I'll try to do that. Thank you very much, sir.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care. All right, we... I guess that pretty much does it for the program. Are we out of time? I think we're out of time. We're getting close to being out of time. Thanks for joining us tonight, Truth Seekers. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Truth Seekers, Mike.